Hello, everyone. I'm John Montoya.
And I'm John Pairings.
We're authorized infinite banking practitioners and hosts of the Strategic Whole Life Podcast.
Episode number 102. Welcome to Strategic Whole Life. Today, we have a special guest, one of our clients, Ian King, who is a young go-getter out there in Minneapolis, Minnesota area, where he is a tech employee, a real estate investor, and business owner, and avid IBC practitioner. And so we wanted to have him on today to talk about his experiences and what he's seeing out there in the marketplace from a real estate and business aspect, and talk about how he's using the infinite banking concept in his life. So Ian King, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you on. Could you, we can just kind of kick things off and maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got into IBC, all those good things.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I appreciate you guys having me on. I've been a long time listener. So it's very cool to actually be here talking with you both on the podcast. So as you mentioned, I live in the Twin Cities area of Minnesota. So I'm just, you know, kind of a suburb here outside of Minneapolis. And you know, from a little bit of background, so I've worked in the tech sector pretty much my entire professional life. So I kind of work in enterprise tech for those listening that are familiar with that. But in addition to that, I've always had really kind of an entrepreneurial side. So I've always been really interested in investing, personal finance, business, things like that. And, you know, really since kind of the entire time that I've been working professionally, I've always done things on the side. One of those things is the real estate space. So I've been buying rentals. Pretty much since I graduated, I think I bought my first rental maybe 4 or 5 months out of college and have been kind of steadily since. I've sold a few, which I'm sure we'll get into later, but I think at the peak, I had somewhere around 30 rentals or so that both in Minnesota and then Michigan as well, that, you know, were just full rentals, you know, kind of single family things all the way up to some small multifamily stuff. So nothing huge compared to some folks out there, but was definitely a lot for me while still working a full-time job. And then over the past few years, I've actually started and purchased a couple of businesses as well. So I've got a commercial cleaning company that really focuses in cleaning, you know, medical, school, manufacturing, office, you know, pretty much anything you can think of on the commercial side, we do from a commercial cleaning perspective. And then I also own a transportation business that I've purchased within like the last 6 months or so as well. So both of those businesses I've got partners in, and the, you know, the partners in those businesses are the full-time operators and CEOs. But it's been really cool for me to kind of get into business ownership from that side as well, both starting and then, you know, learning all there is to learn about acquiring businesses and all the stuff that comes along navigating that as well. So that's kind of been a bit of my journey and focus, you know, kind of on the professional side here.
Maybe we could just start a little bit with the IBC journey side of things. How did you hear about IBC? How'd you kind of get involved? And, you know, what was it about IBC that piqued your interest enough to, you know, really start looking into things and doing your research?
Yeah. So I think the first time I ever heard about anything around insurance was not even the words IBC, but was really just around whole life insurance. I met with a financial advisor probably back right when I was right out of college. And one of the things that they really pushed on me was, hey, you should be putting money into this insurance thing. At the time, I had no idea what it was. I just knew that, you know, at the time I was maybe making $3,000 a month after taxes, and they wanted me to put $2,000 in. And I thought, there's no way I can do this. And I kind of forgot about it. And I really pushed that thinking aside. And I, to be frank, I didn't think about it again for probably another 5 years from there. And I kind of was, you know, to be honest, I just had sort of a gross feeling. It was kind of a slimy push. It was, you know, something that we spent the entire, you know, meeting that I was in there talking about. And, you know, it was, I just didn't walk away with a good feeling. So I really pushed it kind of out of sight, out of mind for a few years. And then, you know, one thing about me is I'm kind of a big learner. I'm kind of a nerd for podcasts and books and things like that. And I'm always listening to something around personal finance or investing in businesses. And, you know, as I was listening to, you know, one of the real estate podcasts out there, and even some of the business buying podcasts out there, I heard some folks that I really admired in this space talking about IBC and leveraging cash value and kind of doing that to buy, you know, whether it be rental properties or even buy businesses and things like that. And so from there, I really went on a kind of an education binge, and I found every book and podcast and, you know, everything that I could find. And, you know, that's when I happened to find you guys. And I think I listened to every single episode that you had at the time. in like maybe a 3 or 4 day period. So I was just listening nonstop, trying to get all the information I could. And from there, I bought Nelson's books. So I bought Becoming Your Own Banker, and then I bought, Building Your Warehouse of Wealth, read both of those. To be honest, they were way over my head. I think the first time I read Becoming Your Own Banker, I got way too lost in the illustrations, and I was trying to pencil out the math and try to learn everything that that I could. And, I'm somebody who really likes to act. So I think after reading through the book and listening to the podcast, I reached out to your guys' website, got in touch with John Pairings, and, we were on a call, and I think within maybe 2 weeks, I had my first policy in place, and, I've been kind of running with IBC from there. I think to maybe go back to your question around what really intrigued me, I'll say that it was, having control and access to my own capital. But, the other thing was just to have some reliability. A lot of things I touched on in the beginning are spaces that have some volatility. They're not super reliable areas at all times. I certainly have months in my businesses where I'm way up and then we're way down. I have real estate deals that have gone really well, and I've had real estate deals where, I've lost tens of thousands of dollars. And so I really liked being able to have something that had, a guaranteed side to it, where I knew if I were to look out 5, 10, 15 years later, and I was diligent about paying a premium and, making sure that, hey, as I take loans, I'm paying them back and I'm being an honest banker, that, I would be in a strong financial position. And it was really a mindset shift for me to build my foundation first. I think I've always jumped into a lot of things without, maybe earlier than I should have, or without maybe being properly capitalized. And I've gotten burned by that a few times. And so I think I really saw the power in IBC, and just, to be honest, really being able to build out my foundation was something that was really important to me.
I think it's interesting that you had a whole life policy that you started, and for your own reasons, you said you didn't really pay attention to it or look at it for maybe another 4 or 5 years. So in a way, you really had have had the benefit of hindsight, even though you may not have looked upon it that way. I'm curious, once you did read Nelson's book and you listened to the podcast, what were your feelings going back to this whole life policy that you had started 5 years ago? How did your impression of what you did change with what you learned?
Sure. And I may make one correction there, John. So I actually did not start it when that.
Oh, you did not start it. Okay.
No. So I kind of walked out of that meeting and thought, this is not for me. And unfortunately, it kind of ruined, I think, the notion of insurance for me for a few years from there. And I really pushed it out of my head. But I will say, when I read the book, I thought, man, I wish I would have done this 5 years earlier. Even if I had done whatever the policy was that they had put in front of me at that time, I think it still would have had benefits that at the time I just couldn't understand. And so I think reading the book really just kind of clicked for me in terms of, oh, I think this is what the guy was trying to say. Now, they weren't affiliated with the Nelson Nash Institute in any way. They were a big, financial planning and insurance house that was just trying to push insurance products. But I think really being able to tie it back, and the book really just opened up my eyes to see, like, wow, I really wish I would have understood this earlier, and I wish I would have acted on it. But I didn't have that initial policy. The first one I did was through you guys a few years ago.
Okay. Got it. Well, interesting that your regret is you wish you would have started 5 years ago, because the most common regret we hear from people is, they say we wish we would have started 20 years ago. So you're definitely in better position. And the fact that you have gotten started and you have gone down the rabbit hole, it's tremendous. And it only gets better as we age, right? Because whole life policies, they lock in your age, and you start to capitalize. And with your entrepreneurial mindset, you need to have capital allocated someplace. Maybe it would be helpful to listeners to hear from you how the capitalization of your whole life policy has helped you in your businesses and in real estate investing.
Yeah. So, and I'll be transparent. So I just entered my third year of the first policy that you guys helped me put in place. And to date, I actually have not taken any policy loan. So I have been really focused on the capitalization phase. I think, you guys talk a lot about that in your podcast, and something I really took to heart, which was not rushing in to leverage the money just because it's sitting there, and really being patient to build up my foundation, you know, really build my system and put it in place. And I'll say I took your advice and I did do a little $200 policy loan just to get through the scaries of making sure that I could take the loan and it's real and I knew how to use it. But I've really been focusing on that capitalization phase and so much so in the fact that I've actually started selling off a number of my rental properties. And so, as I really got into this, one of the things that I was really evaluating was, you know, and it's something I know is talked about, but I don't know, you know, at least in the real estate circles I hang out in, not something that's a huge metric, which is return on equity. So I was looking at some of these houses that I had bought and I had, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 worth of equity on, and yet I'm making $20 in cash flow on them because of, you know, whether the financing or just, hey, stuff breaks and stuff comes up and, you know, the cash flow wasn't crazy. And so I've been looking at, I've been selling those and in the process of doing so right now. I've sold a few and I've got, you know, a few more on the market, and I'm going to continue to kind of do this exercise. And what I'm doing with that money is I'm taking it, I'm buying additional policies, and I'm using it to buy PUA as well and really building out and capitalizing that system. So then, to answer the first part of your question, I can go back and as I start to look at other opportunities, whether it be private lending, whether it be investing in syndications, you know, buying or flipping homes of my own, buying more businesses, I'm doing that with a well-structured foundation that I know that, you know, can help propel me and again, be there to build on and make smart investments going forward. So maybe not as sexy of an answer, but again, I've really just been focusing on the capitalization and really trying to not rush into investments and really build that foundation first and then, you know, go back and really make investments from there.
Yeah, I think you're doing it right. And in this case, I want to say boring is doing it right, because you'll never be in a worse position by having access to cash and having access to the cash value in your policies. That just puts you in a better position long term. And you know, a takeaway for me in how I'm hearing you redirecting money, you're choosing to redirect money from one asset class, property, real estate property, and you're redirecting that money into another asset class, which is also property. And I think what people sometimes don't understand is that when you have a guaranteed cash value contract, that is property. Much like real estate property. It's a different asset class, but this is an asset class that comes with a contractual guarantee that it's going to increase in value every single year for the rest of your life. And it's great to own real estate, but I think it's even greater to have whole life contracts, because that's another form of property that comes with a ton of benefits that maybe for, you know, speaking to real estate investors out there who quite aren't up to par with their life insurance knowledge to where you are at today, this is really important for those people to better understand life insurance as an asset, as property. So I think what you're doing, I think it's tremendous, and I think you're doing it the right way.
Well, and yeah, and you bring up a couple of interesting points there too, John. And I think one of the big things for me, to be honest, as I was really looking at this, is I had to overcome a little bit of an ego thing when it came to this. I always loved, and I even said it at the beginning of this podcast, I hate when I say it, but, you know, oh, I own whatever, 20 doors, 30 doors, you know, 100 doors, whatever it is that somebody may out there may own. And so I think as I was really starting and debating on going down this route, part of it was me kind of overcoming that to say, I always said there's this ego thing about owning so many doors, but really what I'm focused on is building my foundation, building my wealth, having access to cash and being able to have cash flow. And it's cool to say you own 30 real estate doors, but if those 30 doors are producing less cash or aren't giving you access to capital when you need them, you know, where's the benefit? And I figured, hey, I can have more benefit. I can have the same equity that I have, putting them into a life insurance contract, which is growing for me, as you mentioned, which is, you know, in most years paying a dividend and is continuing to, and then that I can borrow and use to put into other assets that are paying me cash while that cash is still growing, you know, uninterrupted in my life insurance contract. And so I think once I was able to kind of make that mental switch and get over some of the vanity or the ego piece that comes, I think that was the biggest thing I had to overcome when I was really debating this. Because as I run the math, I look at the numbers, it's a no-brainer to do it the way that I'm doing it now. It just took a little bit of, you know, really being able to kind of get out of my own way to do it.
Yeah, well said.
I would like to dig into that a little bit more. You know, so we've mentioned building the foundation a couple times now, and one of my favorite quotes from Montoya is, "You can't build a house by starting with the roof. And so you got to start with the foundation. And you've mentioned that a couple times, Ian. And you also said a couple things that, one, you got burned a couple times by not having the foundation set up. Would you mind expanding on anything?
Yeah, I can give you a couple examples. So, as I was building my portfolio in real estate, I did it without always a lot of access to cash. And so I've borrowed private money. I've borrowed, you know, from hard money. I've borrowed friends and family money. I've used lines of credit off houses. I've used lines of credit off stock investments. And so just off those examples alone, I mean, I had one time where I was borrowing money from a stock portfolio and I was borrowing maybe 60% of the value of that portfolio and the market tanked and I got a margin call. And all of a sudden, I owed $10,000 into the account and I had maybe $8,000 in cash at the time. And so I was scrambling, trying to figure out how I would pay this, you know, saying, oh, shoot, now I got to pay this. I got to figure out then how I'm going to be able to keep this alive. And if the market continues to go down, you know, the broker's like, well, you're going to get another call tomorrow and the next week and whatever until the market rebounds and you get to a place where, you know, it meets your lending threshold. And that's happened to me a number of different times in situations like this. You know, I did a similar thing where, you know, we borrowed hard money and like at least all my projects do. I'm sure there are better real estate investors and flippers out there than I, but whenever I do a project, I think we're going to be done in 6 months and it takes 10 months. And you know, after that 6 month, my interest rate shot up from, I was paying 10% on hard money. I went up to 14%. I had to pay all these fees to keep the money going. And, you know, the hard money lender was, you know, knocking on our door every day, making sure that, you know, everything was in line, getting updates and everything like that, as he should be. But just it was another, you know, hoop I had to jump through. And just, again, something that was a really difficult place to be in because we didn't have access to that capital. And I was leveraging the ways of financing in front of me, which are great ways when you don't have anything else. But they're not always super reliable ways and they're, you know, ways that, you know, where you're really in second or third position sometimes. And those things can change should the market shift or the environment shift. Maybe one more example I'll give you, just a quick one, and then we'll get move on if you want, is I have a commercial loan. So I've got a small apartment building right now that I'm in the process of selling. And we were on a commercial loan. It was a 15-year fixed rate, which in my book, I thought that meant it was fixed for 15 years. About a year and a half ago, as rates really spiked up, the bank came back and had all these loopholes in their contract and basically said, hey, you set up this operating account, you know, you're not using it like we thought you would, so we're going to increase your rate. And I went back and we kind of went back and forth and I said, hey, I'm using it. I just didn't know that you had to be putting a certain amount of money through it each month. And they said, yeah, well, we decided that, you know, you need to have certain thresholds in order to meet. And so just like that, they increased my rate. My payment went up $1,000 a month. And this was a property where, you know, that pretty much ate into my entire profit. And so again, it was just another example for me of, you know, I'm really not in control. I'm at the mercy of a lot of these factors that I have no personal, you know, influence on. And, you know, unfortunately, in those situations, I just had to roll with the punches and, you know, take whatever it was in terms of those outcomes. So I definitely have seen a lot of examples of it. And, you know, those are maybe just a couple that come to mind right away.
I mean, I think this is huge. And I really, you know, we talk to a lot of real estate investors and a lot of times people, especially real estate investors, they have a hard time getting their head around why they would want to put money into a whole life insurance policy when they could be putting that money, you know, towards their next, you know, acquisition, real estate acquisition. And so a few things I'm hearing from you from the real world are access to capital and the fact that the way you finance a real estate deal in the conventional way, you give up a lot of control, number one. But I hear stories all the time where there are always surprises somewhere in the lending agreement, like things that they weren't expecting, powers that can be implemented to, you know, call a loan or increase the rate, or, you know, stop the loan or stop the line of credit based on different stages. I mean, we've talked about a lot of those stories, but they're always kind of third hand coming from our mouths. So it's interesting to hear, you know, your direct experience with some of these things. And how do you feel like IBC you know, as you mentioned, you've been focused on the capitalization phase. How do you think IBC will help with some of this? Do you think you'll completely stop using third-party finance or bank finance or, you know, hard money finance? Or do you think, what is it about IBC that you think is going to help with some of these situations?
Yeah. So I certainly would love to get to a place where the need to use a third-party finance company is no longer there. I know that obviously, especially if I look at kind of the scale that I had been buying, it would be, you know, take quite a while to do that. But I really see myself, to be honest, starting to play a little bit of a different role. I think one thing that IBC has changed my mindset on a bit is the power of cash flow versus net worth. And I think, honestly, with IBC, you kind of get both. A lot of the net worth in my mind, I'm not using up until my goal is to have it there for my wife and my future family. And I get that with IBC. I also get the access to cash, and I can leverage that to use, you know, to buy more things and invest in more things and give me cash flow. But I can also, you know, use IBC as a retirement plan down the road, where I can take, you know, multiple different ways to really take cash flow and take income from IBC down the road, which I know will be there for me. But in terms of real estate specifically, John, I think, yeah, I'm shifting my mindset a bit to really look at to say, hey, instead of maybe buying a house and leveraging IBC, I'm really almost looking at it from like a private lending and a syndication perspective, where I make these investments, whether they be, you know, whatever the number may be, and I get a consistent return. So if I look at private lenders, when I borrow private money, I see the statement at the end of the deal. 50% of the time, the private lender makes more money than I did. Right. So that had me thinking, maybe I'm doing something wrong. I'm taking all the risk. I'm the one signing the guarantees. We're doing all the work. At the end of the day, we're making the same amount of money. And then on the syndication side, really looking at it a way to say, hey, I still have my, you know, I'm leveraging, you know, IBC. I'm making an investment in a syndicator. I'm getting cash flow from that syndication. And at the end, I'm getting a payoff for my initial investment. And then some, obviously, if the syndication goes well, all the while I'm continuing to service that loan, you know, my IBC policy is compounding and continuing to grow and pay dividends in the background. And so again, I think IBC more than anything has really just changed my mindset around things. And again, it's really had me have more of a focus around cash flow, access to cash, less on net worth and kind of that phantom number that I was so focused on, you know, throughout my 20s and even up into a few years ago.
And so just speaking of syndications real quick, do you see any risks with syndications? You know, so it sounds like you're seeing an improvement in the process there, where it's more focused on cash flow. You don't have to, you know, sign away all these guarantees. But what are the risks, if any, that you see with syndication type deals?
Yeah. So obviously, I think from my perspective, and I'll, you know, again, be transparent, I have not invested in a syndication before, but I certainly have done my homework on them and met with a number of syndicators. So when I'm ready, I, you know what I'm getting into. But I think obviously the operator is really the big thing. So when you're looking at a syndication, you're really vetting the operator. You want to make sure that that operator has a track record, that operator is reliable, that operator can, you know, knows how to buy, reposition and manage assets in that particular area that you're looking to buy. And so I think obviously the big risk is the operator, and the big risk is, hey, the money that you put aside, if you invest $50,000 into a syndication deal, that money is not guaranteed to come back to you. But to take it back to IBC, one thing that gives me a little bit more peace with that is I know that, hey, that $50,000 in theory is still growing and compounding inside of my life insurance contract. And so if I lose the $50,000, yes, I'm going to be an honest banker and I'm going to pay back that $50,000, but I know that I'm not losing the velocity on that money, even with an investment like that. And so I think, again, John, the big risk would really be kind of around the operator itself. And again, making sure that you vet the operator and that you know who you're investing with is somebody that you can trust and that, you know, again, is going to be there and be a reliable, solid operator for the asset that they're purchasing.
And then out of this, you said one other thing that hit me, and I never thought of it this way. So this is pretty awesome. You mentioned you're selling some of your real estate assets, and you said something to the effect of you have the same equity moving from real estate to whole life. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I liked how you said that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I look at a piece of property, and I use simple numbers here, if I have a $100,000 property that I have $50,000 worth of equity in, essentially my net worth goes up 50%, or sorry, it's $50,000. Right. And so what I'm looking at doing is saying, hey, instead of hanging on to it in that asset where it's a very hard to get access. If I actually needed it, I would either have to refinance, take a line of credit, or move to sell it, which as I'm going through the sales process, I can tell you it's taken longer than I thought it would. And had I needed that money and been in a position where I was in a crunch to get access to that cash, I would have been in, you know, I would have been out of luck. And so I'm really looking at that to say, hey, as I move this money, what I want to do is I want to take it and put it into a vehicle where A, I have access to it, and B, where I know it's growing. And I know down the road, I can have a predictable look at what that money is going to grow into. And I'm also then able to take that money and leverage it into things that, to be honest, will pay me a better cash flow than I'm getting in those deals. Now, that's not every real estate deal. I will say there are deals I have where the cash flow is such and the equity position is such that I'm still hanging on to those, and I see them as a good asset to still hang on to. But a lot of those things where my return on equity, as I mentioned, is really low, that's where I'm looking at getting that equity out, and I'm moving it into, you know, a life insurance contract or buying PUA, et cetera, to really have better access and better use of that money. And I know an objection I hear when I tell my friends this is, wow, I can't believe you're going to pay those taxes. And I have maybe an unpopular opinion here, which is, if I'm making money and I'm getting a gain, I'm okay to pay the taxes. It's money that I didn't have. And so I'm okay to pay the taxes. And when I run the math and I look at the long-term use of putting that money inside of a whole life insurance contract versus leaving it in, you know, in a B-class home, which a lot of these are, that's going up maybe 2% a year and I'm making minimal cash flow on, it's a no-brainer for me that the money is better used and I have better uses for it down the road in my insurance contract.
That's a great explanation. And, you know, we talk a lot about in this industry, you know, different asset classes and the control you have over those different asset classes. And real estate is very popular right now. And one of the things that I think people miss is when you put money into a real estate, the money, we call it having the money locked up in the walls of the house. And you kind of just hit the nail on the head there where you said if you had needed access to that capital, it took you longer to get to it than what you anticipated. And I think a big problem out there is, you know, people look at, you know, real estate equity, they look at, you know, home equity lines of credit, different ways to source capital, and they really are not putting enough emphasis on the fact that they're not in control of whether or not they can actually get to that capital when they need it. You know, lines of credit can be called, lines of credit can be canceled. It takes longer to sell a property than what you think it might. So, you know, you're really speaking the language of, you know, what we talk about all the time. I mean, no big surprise there, but it's just the control that you have, comparing different sources of capital. There really aren't too many that stack up to whole life insurance from a liquidity and control, aspect.
And, you know, John, I think I'm still very much a proponent, as I know you guys both are, that real estate is a great place to put your money and is a great place Absolutely. To build wealth. I just really looked at the mechanics of the order of operations. When should I Right. put that money in, and where should that money go first before it goes into Right. real estate? And you've got a great illustration that really sold me on it in terms of really seeing and running the math on how that would actually work. And I think it's really that mindset shift for folks that, you know, we're not saying that real estate is not a great place to put your money. I you know, made and lost money in real estate, and real estate has been a huge foundation for the wealth that I've built to this point. But I think, wow, had I been able to put it in my insurance contracts first and then leverage it from there, I can only think of how much farther along I would be. And so I think it's really just that order of operations and getting people to understand that, versus saying, hey, well, I want to buy that property right now, have one use for that money, and then have to start over again, save my way up to my next down payment, buy the next property, and start all over again. It's just a perpetual cycle where you're saving down to zero, saving down to zero, versus taking a step and saying, hey, I'm just putting one step in between those actions. And that one step can make a huge difference, especially when you look out over the longevity of, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
And you know, you mentioned liquidity. So another thing to think about is, a lot of times real estate investors, in their mind, they're always thinking of, okay, well, I've got to put money in whole life insurance, or I could buy this asset. And they're looking at it as either or, right? So number one, life insurance is the and asset. So you can put it in life insurance first and then use it to buy real estate. So that's the first thing, which you just have been alluding to. But the other thing is, would you agree that real estate investors need to really just be sitting on a significant amount of cash in order to just run their real estate investment businesses?
Yeah, I think access to cash in real estate is huge, and people that don't think so, in my opinion, haven't been around real estate long enough to know, because it's not a matter of if, it's when you're going to have to replace a roof, you're going to have a furnace go out, you're going to have a tenant destroy your home, or all the above. And right. So having access to cash is always there. And I think regardless of what endeavor you do, I can speak for my businesses as well, we always have an unplanned expense. You know, people think those unplanned expenses come around once in a while, but I think the more stuff you do and the farther you've been in those games and investing, those things happen constantly. And so being prepared and being able to weather those storms is oftentimes the difference of what keeps people in business and what puts people out of business.
That's amazing. And, you know, we had in episode 100, we had a couple of business owners on to, you know, celebrate our 100th episode. I was saving you, Ian, for this one. So that's why you didn't get invited to that one. But they both mentioned several instances where, you know, their whole life insurance saved their bacon. And, you know, what's the rate of return on, you know, keeping your business alive? So and just going back to the sitting on cash, I just wanted to point out to the listeners, especially the real estate investor listeners who are kind of, you know, exploring this and they're having trouble, you know, justifying paying a life insurance premium when they could be, you know, putting their money into the next real estate investment. Well, it doesn't have to be that. What about just the cash that you absolutely need to have on hand? What if you just made that your whole life insurance policy and then you kept all your cash flow, you know, for all your real estate? You don't have to interrupt the real estate investment process. Although, Ian alluded to a talk that I have. I can show you the math that if you do interrupt the process, you'll long term, you'll come out way ahead. But if you don't want to do it, you don't have to. But what if you just kept the cash that you need instead of spending that cash? You never interrupt the compounding process on just that cash that you need to have on hand to run your real estate investment operation.
Yeah, pretty powerful. And I think the main thing I'm hearing you say, Ian, is that, you really need to prioritize savings before investing. And too many people, they get out over their skis and, you know, they just jump right to investing right away. And to get back to, you know, building the foundation before the roof, I mean, that's exactly it right there. And like we've said on the podcast over and over again, you'll never be in a worse position by having access to cash. And you're given examples that hopefully listeners can relate to. I think they can. I think we all can, to be honest, because I mean, life is challenging. And how many times have we all wished, you know, if we didn't have access to cash, that we did have access to cash and under our own terms where we can control it and control our own destiny. And the you know, just getting back to fundamentals, you start with savings. And you'll never be in a worse position by having access to cash in a whole life policy. It's kind of 101 stuff.
And you know, I think that's a great point. I think one thing too for people to think about that are listening is, you know, putting your money in a whole life insurance contract is doing something. I think, you know, when I was younger, and I have this problem today, I still am the same way today. I always feel like I need to be doing something, whether it's buying the next house or the next business or buying the next stock or whatever the case may be. And, you know, I have a lot of shiny object syndrome, as I know a lot of folks out there do. But I think one thing that I've really has helped me with that is, you know, putting money into a whole life insurance policy is doing something. You are bettering yourself. You're putting that money into a place where you know you're going to get guaranteed growth, where you can access it. And so, you know, if you can set aside and know that, hey, you're not missing out, you know, this is still doing something, you're very much putting yourself in a better position, you know, and I think when I look out 10, 15 years from now, I'm going to really thank myself that I spent the time to do this and that I put my money inside of my whole life insurance contracts first. You know, and again, and that I didn't get over, you know, over eager or get rush things and not have the patience to really be methodical about how I'm going to go about this approach. And so, again, I would just say that to anybody listening that putting your money in a whole life insurance contract is doing something. And so, you know, again, I think that has been something that's really helped me kind of get over some of that shiny object syndrome. And I'll tell you, now that I have money in my insurance contracts and I've got a foundation that's really starting to be built, I'm thinking twice about investment opportunities. I had a house that was brought to me the other day and I passed on it. 5 years ago, I would have invested in that house all day long. But now I think twice about, you know, the uses of my capital and really where I want to put it. And that extra step is something that I never had that, you know, I never really had that visual before. I never had that, you know, kind of eye on things. And I was so eager to jump into things. And this has really given me a second place to say, okay, well, actually, let me look. Let me make sure that this is really the best use of my capital and that this is an investment I want to make.
I love that. I was actually going to ask you, has owning a whole life policy made you more discernible in how you choose your investments? And yeah, you beat me to the punch. That was perfect.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, that's actually what you just said is so much more important just from a general principle in personal finance. Having a little bit of an, you called it an extra step or a beat in time to think about, you know, what we're actually spending our money on. And so much of what we do in this day and age is unconscious. And unfortunately, the spending is what typically becomes an unconscious decision rather than saving. And so I think, you know, what we try to talk about here is let's figure out a system or a process to make the savings unconscious. And you also mentioned that as well, where once you have your whole life insurance policy in place, like it kind of helps with our FOMO or the shiny object syndrome, where, you know, we kind of make this commitment. You got to take a little bit, there's a little bit of a leap of faith, but not even much because it's all just guarantees. So it's like, okay, I guess I'll go ahead and take this leap of faith into 100% guarantees. So, you know, but you kind of have to do it because of the shiny object syndrome and FOMO. It feels like a leap of faith. But once you have it in place, every single one of my, well, I shouldn't say every single one of my clients, because I have had some clients that get over their skis. They don't listen to what I'm saying. They borrow all their money and then something happens and they can't keep paying a premium. That's an unfortunate thing. But the ones that, you know, I had to really talk to about the strategy that we're doing. You know, I have one who's one of my best friends from that we grew up together. And he was just super into Bitcoin. He was super into putting his money in his brokerage account, you know, because everything was kind of going up and up at that point. And I really had to talk and almost convince him to say, hey, why don't you just put some of that over here into life insurance? And so he bought a whole life insurance policy with me. And he called me, you know, I don't know, the other day. He's like, hey, I just really want to thank you. Like, you know, I feel like a responsible adult when I just knowing that I have this in place and knowing that on autopilot, I'm putting it somewhere that's not part of the shiny object thing. It's like it's forcing me to just have one little area of my life that's like responsible, you know, going into safety as opposed to just putting money out there into the unknown and kind of hoping for the best. So, man, that really that hit the nail on the head, Ian. What, as far as like, you know, people looking at infinite banking right now, you know, maybe let's talk about it from two ways, because you do both. You're an investor and business owner, but you're also a W-2 employee. So we talked a lot about the real estate. Why don't we wrap that component up and just say what, and we're kind of wrapping up the episode as well. Like what would you say to someone evaluating infinite banking? Maybe they're a real estate investor and they're just really, they're like, man, I don't know. Is this something that makes sense? Like what would you say to that type of person right now?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is, you know, you got to dive in and learn. I think that was the biggest thing for me. And I'm a firm believer that the learning has to come from the individual. As great as it is listening to the two of you and consuming content from other peers in your guys' world, you have to be dedicated to learning and understanding it. And really, you know, it's on you to learn that, you know, and then I think from there, it's listening to the right sources. So I'll tell you one thing that I do for every piece of content that I consume is whoever the author is or the poster of the LinkedIn post or the YouTube video or whatever, I go to the Nelson Nash Institute website. I look at the practitioner finder and I make sure that who I'm listening to is somebody that's been through and is a part of the NNI. I think there's so much information, and IBC seems to be a huge buzzword. John, I know you and I have talked about it before, that, you know, just in terms of there's so much noise out there for it, good, bad, everything in between. But I think, you know, really vetting and making sure that you're listening to the right sources. But then for me, the big thing was acting. I didn't know everything. I still, by no means do I know a lot. I'm learning every single day. There's, you know, and I don't know that I'll ever be done learning. But I think when I felt like I had a good enough grasp to feel confident about what I was doing, I went all in and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. You know, and I worked, you know, John, with you, and you helped me set up a policy that was, you know, a good policy for me at that time in my life, and was, you know, something that, you know, definitely was saving a good chunk of money, and, you know, but wasn't something that made me uncomfortable or that I was scared about, like, well, if I regret this, I'm really going to be in a bad position. And so I think that, you know, between doing the research and then acting, I think those are really two big things that, you know, I'm happy that I was able to do pretty quickly. And I think for anybody getting into this, you know, the being undecided is something I think that is really challenging. And there's always going to be questions that you're going to have. But I think as you get into it and you really start to learn, there's always going to be things you're going to pick up. You're going to learn more. You're going to feel more confident about your knowledge. And, you know, every single person on every podcast I've ever listened to around IBC says they wish they would have started earlier. And, you know, I have to echo those sentiments in terms of, you know, getting started.
Do you have friends your age, maybe that you're invested with, or just people that you know your age that have asked you about Whole Life and what you're doing? And, you know, if so, like, what are some hangups that they have that maybe you have to try to dispel?
Yeah. So I talk about it a lot. I think my friends and my wife probably hate how much I talk about it, but I do really bring it up a lot. I think,
you'll be in the business soon enough. That's how it starts.
I know who I'm coming to for a job, I guess. But so, you know, it's John, to answer your question, it certainly is something that I talk a lot about in the circles that I'm in. And I've really tried to, you know, push gently on friends and business partners and others. And I think, you know, I hear a couple of hangups all the time. One is, I can only put in a few, you know, maybe $500 a month, and I don't know if it makes sense to start with that. And, you know, I can tell you that it does. You know, getting started is the important thing. And I think whether your first policy is $500 a month or $50,000 a month or anything in between, you know, I don't think there's such a thing as too small. I think getting started and being familiar with the mechanics is really the key thing. So I think that is one hangup I always hear. And the other one that I hear, and I have a challenge explaining this, I'm not as technically sound as you two, but is, why would I ever pay interest to borrow my own money? And I've tried to explain that and really, you know, offer some insight on really what you're doing there. But I think that is something that I've found that people really have a hard time getting over, which is they can't fathom paying interest to borrow their own money. Even though I know that's not technically what's happening, in their mind, that's capital they've set aside that they have, and paying interest on it is something that doesn't make sense when they're like, well, I can just borrow from my Chase bank account and not have to pay any interest. Although losing the compounding on all that, and again, everything in that goes along with that, you know, kind of goes out the window. But I would say those are really two of the big objections that they've had. So I think one of them I've been able to kind of talk through and help people understand. But the other one I think is a challenge. And even with explanations I've given, you know, that seems to be a tough pill for people to swallow, you know, paying interest to borrow that money.
That's pretty good. I haven't actually heard that one in a while. Should we just tackle it real quick?
Yeah, I think we should. Why not?
The short answer is you're not borrowing your own money. What you're doing is you're creating a present value in a life insurance policy that's known as the cash value. And what you have is a guaranteed loan provision collateralized by that cash value to borrow the insurance company's money. So it is 100% not your own money that you're borrowing. The money and the cash value that's created in the life insurance policy just acts as collateral. And it's really the death benefit at the end of the day, especially with Whole Life, that ends up being the collateral allows you a guaranteed source of capital that the insurance company lends you. And it comes from the insurance company's general fund. It does not come from your policy. So that's probably unless Montoya has anything to add to that, I think that's probably the shortest way to answer that is that you're not. So that's what's going on there.
I have two ways that I just thought of how I would answer that. For the real estate investors out there, when you go to refinance or take a loan from a property, you know, what is the collateral for that loan? It's the property, right? And who determines the value? Well, an appraiser generally does, or if you're selling it, it's the market value of whatever someone, the next person's willing to buy it. But you have property values that are the underlying collateral for that loan, and there's a cost for that capital that you're going to pay to a bank. But that value is, it's going to fluctuate. And when you borrow from a policy, what is the collateral? It's your cash value. And that's the present value that Perrins was talking about, but it's also tied to a future death benefit that's guaranteed. So you're good for that loan no matter what. So there's, you know, understanding that you know, what is the collateral, and knowing the difference between asset classes that you may be utilizing. But for the people who just have any objection to paying interest, I would point this out, that when you pay cash for something, you're giving up the ability to earn interest on that money forever. It's gone. That you're constantly having to start over from zero. Let's say you save $20,000 or $50,000, whatever that number is, and then you use that money someplace else. That money is, you know, it's one use, and then that's it. And then you're having to rebuild that savings account all over again. And the thing that people miss when they do this is that not only the uninterrupted compounding of that money, had you had it in a whole life policy, but you also not only have to replace that principal, but people forget that they also need to replace the interest that they otherwise would have earned on that money, and then the compounding interest on top of that. And people never make that connection. And I think this second way of explaining it is probably more powerful, because people completely don't think about the second order effects of paying cash for something. And then the third order effect, which is the compounding interest that you're also going to lose by never having access to that money again, and the interest on interest. And here all along, you have this whole life policy giving you complete access to the cash values, and always growing uninterrupted, even while that money is being used someplace else. It's why I call it a financial unicorn. It just gives you so much clarity. And, you know, if your vision is clear about how you're managing your money, the decisions are quite easy. That's something that I think for most people, you know, just think about it, spend a little bit more time thinking about how money compounds over the long run. And does it behoove you to manage your money better? And if so, what is a better way? Well, if you're listening to the show, I think you're taking strides to coming to the same conclusion that I think the three of us already have.
Nice. Yeah. Nelson, just to sum it up with from the book, you know, you finance everything you buy. You either pay interest to someone else when you use their money, or you give up interest you could have earned when you use your own. And that's a core principle of the infinite banking concept. And it's not specific to the infinite banking concept. I mean, the concept of economic value added, it comes from that. So this is like basic corporate finance, economic value added. So it's not an unknown thing or a new thing that, you know, only we know about. But it is a fairly unknown concept in the world of personal finance, because there's so much misinformation out there about like staying out of debt and, you know, never paying interest or minimizing the interest. And it's like, well, the wealthiest people in the world, they absolutely use debt as a tool. So you just got to look at the right way to use debt. And if you're looking at it that way, the infinite banking concept and having this guaranteed loan provision that, you know, Montoya said, the underlying collateral is guaranteed. It doesn't get much safer than that in terms of using debt in a correct way. Well, this has been a great talk, guys. We'll wrap up the episode here. And Ian, just want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing some of your insights and how you've been using IBC in the real world and some of the real world things that you're coming up against. Because as we know, you know, money is not necessarily just the math that goes along with it. There's things that happen in real life that change the way that the math works. So this has been, I think, hopefully super eye-opening to, you know, some of the listeners out there. If any of this is resonating with you guys out there, head over to strategicwholelife.com and you can schedule a free 30-minute consultation with Montoya and myself. And if you're one of the type of people like I was that just likes to keep learning as much as you can before you actually, you know, talk to someone, we have an online course, IBC Mastery, just for you. And you can get that right at the top of the homepage of strategicwholelife.com. All right, guys. Thanks again.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, John.
Thanks, guys.
See you next time.